everybody. It is Katie Kestner. I am the primary host of the Dear Katie podcast, and we are so delighted to have you take this journey with us on our weekly podcast episodes. I just want to remind everyone to do great self-care. Thriving is part of the purpose of this podcast, and we definitely want you to take a break at any time. Warm bath, fresh air, walk a dog, have a bite of chocolate, whatever you need to do good care for yourself. Just as a reintroduction, if you're not familiar with me, I am the woman who was on the cover of Time magazine at age 18 as the first in history to speak out nationally and publicly as the victim of date rape. And HBO made a film about me, and I went on to become the executive director of the Take Back the Night Foundation. We are the oldest, largest global movement on sexual violence in all forms for all people in the world. So we encourage you to visit our website for lots more information. So I'm going to turn it over to our host and our guest for today. Hey, everybody. We are back with the Dear Katie podcast. This is Katie Kestner. And as many of you already probably know, I am the founder of Take Back the Night, but I'm also a survivor myself. At the age of 18 years old, I appeared on the cover of Time magazine. Unfortunately, because of a worst case scenario on a date, the third weekend, I went out with another student at my college when I was a new first year student. And at that ripe old point in time, decades ago, there was no such thing as date rape. And I said, yes, there are such things as known offenders in our lives who can also harm and hurt us, not just strangers grabbing us out of bushes and hiding in parking lots. So I am that one who was the first to do that. And since then, we have grown our Take Back the Night Foundation to have chapters and events and virtual events for the entire globe, as well as a legal support hotline, which brings me to our guest today. Emily, my co-host, Emily Wang, will introduce Hansen, our special guest, but it is directly related to our outreach to support our survivors with legal options, advocacy, and how to get justice. So Emily, take it away. Who's our special guest today? Oh, and one more quick thing, please. Always good to take good care of yourselves. If you are triggered at any point with the material on the podcast, take a pause, come back to us later, do good self-care, and always, always look to the resources on our website for more ways to stay connected to other survivors. Thanks so much. Emily, to you.
All right. Today, our guest is Hansen Durrani, who is a lawyer, represents victims of sexual violence. He also does a lot of activism work with Black communities. Hansen, why don't you, I guess, in your own words, tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay. Hi. Thank you guys for having me here today. My name is Hansen Durrani. I am in Tulsa, Oklahoma. My partner's name is Jeff Martin. We are... I guess what people would consider an advertising law firm. We advertise a lot on television commercials, the internet, radio, billboards, bus fences, buses, all that sort of thing. And our practice includes obviously car wrecks, which is sort of the bread and butter of any plaintiff's personal injury practice. But we also do institutional sexual abuse cases, and we do a lot of nursing home abuse cases. The institutional sex abuse cases, those are cases where we are going after schools, youth organizations, and churches, and those are mainly the three categories where they have knowingly turned a blind eye to predators and allowed children to be harmed. Unfortunately, we've just had more of these cases than I'd like to say. I just recently got one in Eastern Oklahoma where we think that the school has known for about 5 years. That this guy was a predator, and his victims, have included, third graders, fourth graders, and second grade special needs students. And so he's currently going through the federal system. We're not really going to be able to move forward with the civil case until his criminal case is completed. That's just sort of the way that it works. But once that's done, we're coming gunning for the school system, and I'm also trying my best to impress upon some of our legislators in the Oklahoma State Legislature the need to stiffen up the penalties for failure to report.
Wait, Hanson, that's a whole nother topic. Let's go back to one thing. Let's do all the initiatives you're doing in a second. Let's go back to something I found catching and interesting that you said, turned a blind eye. You know, I myself serve as an expert witness on what the standard of care should be. And I think it's so interesting because nowadays there are all these institutions say, there's no way we could have known about father so-and-so or coach so-and-so or teacher so-and-so because they were able to hide their behavior. What are your thoughts on, you know, they turned a blind eye versus, oh, we couldn't have known?
I don't believe they couldn't have known. I mean, there are certain alarm bells. There are certain, you know, modes of behavior that are just that would make any reasonable person troubled and should make any reasonable person inquire as to what's going on here. If a teacher, a coach, a youth leader buys a child a phone or a tablet so that they can communicate with that child outside the normal course of school or church or the youth organization, if they do so without the parent's permission, that is almost always an indicator that that person is up to something evil. And there's just no way around that. There's no good reason to do that. I mean, if they, you know, went to the parent and there's some legitimate reason for it, then they would go through the regular channels of that.
What about giving kids rides? Like, let's say the kid says, oh, you know, my mom and dad aren't home. Can you drive me home? Do you, you know, should the teacher and coach be doing that too?
Unfortunately, I think that the teacher and the coach shouldn't do that, even if they're well-intentioned and good people. I mean, the fact of the matter is this, is we live in a society now where we really don't have any standards of behavior anymore. I mean, we just don't. I mean, literally all you have to do is get on Facebook, on the Reels, you get on, you know, the TikTok shorts, and you see some, you know, everything is sexualized. You see some of the most vulgar behavior, you know, I mean, you know, in the guise of a YouTube prank or the guise of a Facebook Reel, you know, some random guy walks up to a couple of, you know, girls walking the street and asks them the most sexually suggestive questions. And I'm not being a prude, and I'm certainly not, you know, saying that, I mean, you know, trying to turn the clock back to Victorian times, but we live in a society that is highly sexualized now. It absolutely is. I mean, look at the proliferation of OnlyFans. I mean, who in the world would have thought that there would be a sort of private system of pornography where people are making, you know, hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions of dollars, you know, for every kink and fetish and whatever you can imagine out there. So in a society like that, even if the coach or the teacher or the minister was well-intentioned for their own protection, I don't think they should do that. I don't. And it's sad because that chips away at the sense of community that we should have.
Yeah. Hanson, do you feel like schools are and organizations that are in charge of young people are adequately, you know, informing their employees about this no-no practice?
I think the good ones are. I think the good schools will and the administrators who care and who are aware or who simply just don't want someone like me knocking on their door with a lawsuit are doing all they can to, you know, to have you know, standard operating procedures, to have training, you know, in-service training, to discuss with, you know, the people working at the school, hey, this is acceptable behavior, this is not acceptable behavior, this is, you know, if you're in a quandary, this is sort of what you need to do. And they bring it to the forefront. I mean, it's an uncomfortable subject for people. It really is. It's an uncomfortable subject for a lot of people. But the fact is that it happens. All you have to do is read the news on the internet, you know, watch your local news. And within a short period of time, you see some story about some child that has been, you know, violated basically by somebody they trusted. And I mean, you know, the responsibility, listen, the safety of children is all of our responsibility. I mean, just we as a society, we have an obligation to protect children. Okay. And we need to, you know, in order to do so, we have to have, you know, procedures and manners of behavior and things like that. But when you sort of live in a society the way we do now, which is just sort of kind of chaotic, and it really is, I mean, we certainly don't have sort of this, you know, standards of acceptable behavior that we had even say 20, 30, 40 years ago. And, you know, so people are a little more outrageous with things and lines get pushed and things like that. And I think that's one reason, too, why some of these people you know, they seek out positions to be near children. I mean, it's absolutely, absolutely disgusting.
Hanson, you're such a wealth of experience and knowledge on this point. I wanted to describe a case I dealt with once as an expert that was really challenging. You know how you said when the coach or the employer gave the kid a phone? What about this one is a 16-year-old girl who fell in love with her teacher, and she's a minor, and she made his Gmail address to circumnavigate the school's ability to track them, and she taught him how to go around the system. What do we do when it's not the teacher giving the kid a phone, but the student trying to work the system, if you will?
Well, I mean, in this particular case, if the coach was an unwilling participant, meaning that like this girl just had a crush on him, thought she was in love with him.
Totally. She did.
And kind of went after him. Well, then you know what? There should be some consequences for her for doing that. And that's the other thing. Just like when somebody cries false rape charges, if somebody, you know, accuses somebody of rape and they had nothing to do with it and they didn't do it, and it's some sort of revenge plot, or you see this, I don't do family law, but I've heard about this in like, you know, divorce cases where a mother will accuse the father of sexual abuse when there's absolutely no indication of it, he's absolutely not guilty, hasn't done anything, then there ought to be very severe penalties for people that do that. Because here's the thing. When people do that, when they bring false claims, all they do is hurt people who have real claims. It's the same thing with, like, you know, claims of racism. I mean, listen, if you have a legitimate claim of somebody being racist, then the person ought to get whatever they get. But if someone's bringing a false claim of that, then all they do is harden people's hearts for somebody who might have a legitimate claim down the road. And so, again, you know, one of my big issues with our society now is we really don't have consequences for behavior anymore. I mean, people sort of act however they want. Oftentimes they get away with it. And there's really nothing that's done. There's no real consequence to some of the people's actions like there used to be. We've sort of eliminated the social, you know, shame. With the concept of shame in some respects was a powerful, you know, way to sort of keep people's behavior in some sort of check. And so, you know, now people have no shame whatsoever. I mean, I think we really begin to see it when you go back to sort of, you know, I mean, and again, I'm not saying this in any kind of partisan way, so I don't want people to misunderstand me. But when you went back with the President Clinton deal and the Monica Lewinsky deal, I mean,
oh gosh,
you know,
what a nightmare. Yeah, What's the definition of is?
Yeah, exactly. And prior to that, you know, the guy, you know, a president would have just resigned. I mean, they would have just said, okay, you know what, this kind of came up, you know, okay, you know, this probably was inappropriate, I shouldn't have done this, I'm resigning, and da-da. Instead of, it's just like, nope, hey, I'm just going to do what I want to do. And so, you know, when you have a society like that where you just don't have consequences, it leads us down a road, you know. So
Emily, what are your thoughts for Hanson?
I guess I'm thinking a little bit about like a lot of the conversations that we're having about I think older people or like adults or teachers in these situations claiming like, oh, this kid like very clearly was giving me these signs that they wanted it. And I think that there's this really interesting conversation that's happening about like, well, you're the teacher in that circumstance and it is your job to say no.
Absolutely.
And, yeah.
100%. Absolutely 100%. I mean, you know, I mean, here's the thing. Kids, particularly teenagers, they're going through all sorts of social changes. They're going through emotional changes. Physiologically, their bodies are full of chemicals and hormones. They're changing. They're making the transition from childhood to adulthood. And so, of course, they're going to have these very, very strong emotions. I mean, there's a real reason, like, for example, why people love their high school music so much. You know, why sort of every generation has a fondness for the music that was going on while they were teenagers, is because there's a neuro imprint of that music, right? And that's sort of the same thing that's happening with them as they're growing up, and they're emotional. But an adult man who some 15, 16-year-old girl thinks she's in love with, that man should be doing everything he can to disabuse her of that notion. I mean, absolutely should not encourage that in any way. And certainly, you know, that's the most disgusting.
I love what you're saying.
Let me just say this, Kate.
No, first, go.
Yeah, to say she was asking for it, I mean, that's just absolutely the most disgusting thing that someone can say. I mean, that's like the concept of the mindset of like, hey, someone can't rape a prostitute. I mean, how can you do? These are human beings. They're people. They're human beings. And you know, and it's so anybody that would put up that for a defense, I mean, if I could restrain myself from wanting just to punch him in the throat, you know, I would do my best to eviscerate him, you know, and I'll just give you an example though, of going back to about, turning a blind eye to it. I had a case where it was an 11-year-old immigrant girl, and it was a 43-year-old teacher, and he got arrested and he got sentenced away. So he was in county jail awaiting transportation to prison. And one of his female coworkers, a teacher at the school, took a letter from this little girl who had been groomed, right? She's been groomed. She thinks she's in love. Took a letter from her to this guy while he was in jail. She got caught. And unfortunately, they didn't prosecute her. Now, we took her to task in the deposition, you know, and rightfully so in the civil case. But here's the thing. She should have been prosecuted. She should have lost her license to teach, and she probably should have done, a year or 18 months in jail. And because here's the thing, if we sent a message to these people that know something's going on but don't have the integrity or the moral courage to stand up, and we punish them for that failure, what's going to happen? Then these other cowardly people will step up and say, if for no other reason than fear of punishment, will step up and say, you know what, I better say something because I don't want to get caught up in this. And what's the net result of that? The net result of that is that you stop the perpetrator from hurting the victim longer, and you prevent them from getting more victims, because these guys never stop at one. That's the thing. They never stop. The recidivism rate is through the roof. They don't stop. Okay. And that's why I think really, frankly, it ought to be a capital crime. If you are a rapist or if you are a child molester, it should be a capital crime. You should receive the death penalty. Okay. They will send some young black man to prison for 25 years for marijuana, and Chester the molester gets 7 years and some counseling. And that's absolutely disgusting, and it's unfair, and it's wrong.
Wait, Hanson, you're talking so fast. You're saying so much. It's so good. It's so good. I want to go back to the hanging, corporal punishment, like how do we deter? But before we get there, one thing I'm questioning is, you know, when someone ticks over, let's say a potential predator, they tick over to age 18, I'm an adult, and now every sex offense I have is definitely a felony. Do you have any thoughts on how can we better prepare these 18-year-olds to say, like, nope, your time's up. If you start having sex with these minors, like, it's going to be, and I had that question, like, how do we better inform them? And then who's protecting the predators when you encounter them? Like, I hate to say it, is their cool sister? Is it their wife? Is their mama? Well, who's protecting them?
Sometimes the family members don't want to believe it. I mean, sometimes the family members of the predators don't actually want to believe it, because a lot of these times these people are very charming. They ingratiate themselves. I mean, you know, they're often, you know, particularly in when you're talking about like coaches or ministers, they're people who are prominent in their communities, depending on the size of the community. They're well known. You know, they're in various organizations. They serve on boards. I mean, they're which is what's so scary about them, is because it's kind of like, oh my God, you know, who are they? You know, but their families, a lot of times their families simply do not want to believe it, despite the wealth of evidence. They don't want to believe it. And I mean, I have sympathy for the families. Who would want to believe that about somebody? Who would want to believe that their loved one, that their father, that their husband, that their brother is a vile predator, is a vile rapist or a molester? Nobody wants to believe that. But in terms of who protects them, I think, is a lot of times you have these school systems and these administrators and these HR people who simply either don't want to get involved and they just kind of hope they can sweep it under the rug and nothing's going to happen. Okay. Or, you know, they just don't want to deal with the consequences of it. And so, you know, they're cowardly. They are absolutely abject, moral, craven cowards. Okay. And they do an enormous amount of damage. And as I was saying earlier, I really, I think one of the things that we could do as a nation, and I would like to see in every state, is people advocating for more severe penalties for failure to report. I mean, you have a duty to report. I mean, my God, some young child that is being victimized, you know, repeatedly, even if the child has been groomed and the child thinks they're in love or whatever else, they are a child. They're a child. They're not capable of making that kind of a decision. And they're being robbed of their innocence and they're being robbed of their childhood. Okay. So if I had my way, honestly, I would see that those people would be stripped of whatever teaching credentials, ministerial credentials, and they would go to prison, and they would go to prison for a decent enough time that we send a message to everybody else. If you say something, if you see something, you better say something.
Hanson, I think you mentioned this before. You remember you said they keep doing it over and over again. That's my only worry is, like, if we let the predator who's addicted to molestation and child abuse out, are the prisons doing enough to, like, make sure 5 years later they're not going to do it again?
No, they're not. Now, you know, there are some states that have some laws where they try to keep them in longer, you know, even after their sentences on some things. And of course, people come out and they say that's a violation of their constitutional rights, or they say these various things like that. But the fact of the matter is, okay, that these people, I mean, their recidivism rate is so high, they can't help themselves. All right. And so, you know, it's, how can I say this? I mean, a rattlesnake may not be inherently evil because a rattlesnake does what a rattlesnake does. Okay. But it's still dangerous and poisonous, and you don't want to have it. You don't want to have a bunch of them hanging out in your house.
So okay.
And that's the same thing about these people. I mean, it's not that on a human level, I think that there are some of these people who just are sick and they can't help themselves. But the fact is that doesn't make them any less dangerous. I mean, it's kind of like this, Katie. If I, you know, take my pistol out and I pull it out and I'm kind of messing around with it and I shoot you accidentally in the stomach, or I pull it out and I shoot you on purpose, you're still just as shot. I mean, the intention may make a little difference, but you're still just as hurt. You follow me? And so, you know, the thing about it is the rights of innocent children should trump the rights of anybody else. And that's just how I feel about it. I'm sure that there probably are some bleeding heart folks out there that would disagree with what I'm saying, but there are simply some people who must be culled from the herd. You just have to take them out of society because they cannot function in society. They just can't. Because it boggles my mind really that people don't see that. I mean, these people that they grab these kids or they do what they do with them, and they're in positions of trust and they're betraying everybody and everything around them. Okay. And somehow we're supposed to feel mercy and compassion for them. I'm sorry. I'm not capable of doing that. I've seen the fallout. I've seen fathers. I've seen men, you know, big, strong men, farmers, ranchers, you know, guys that work with their hands every day. Guys that, you know, would wade into a room and fight four or five people at a time and probably win. I've seen them break down like babies and cry when their little girls have been hurt and their little boys have been hurt. Mm-hmm. Okay. I've seen the tears. I've sat with families and I've held mothers while the tears just come down their eyes, trying to tell them, listen, this isn't your fault. This is not your fault. You know, you cannot blame yourselves. You did not fail to protect your child. You don't send your child to school expecting they're going to be violated. You send your child to school expecting they're going to be educated, expecting they're going to be cared for, expecting they're going to be loved. You don't expect that something horrific like this is going to happen. And so I'm sorry, but I have no compassion whatsoever for this sort of thing. I am a big believer that we have to take the bull by the horns. We have to stiffen up the penalties for this sort of thing. And we have to make sure that we have a society in which our children are safe. All of our children. And in this particular case, you know, with this immigrant girl, one of the things was, oh, don't tell anybody, because if you tell anybody, your mother will be deported.
Oh,
really? I mean, you know, it took, you know, when I was in the courtroom for the sentencing, and it took every ounce of self-restraint. And I mean, you know, this doesn't sound very professional for an attorney, especially when I've been 26 years I've been doing this, to say, but I had to pray, please God, give me some restraint, because I literally want to come across the bar and beat this guy within an inch of his life. So, I mean, it's just, I'm an advocate for kids. I think kids, they have to be kept safe. They have to be kept safe.
Ooh, I guess like thinking in along that line, especially with like how pervasive the internet has gotten, what role do you think that has to play, like this internet safety and like really paying attention to what kids are consuming and like who they're communicating with. Like, what role do you think that has in sort of preventing this kind of thing from happening?
Well, I think that number one, I think that parents oftentimes are very lazy. And, you know, just as they talked about in my generation, I'm a generation Xer, I guess, you know, I'll be 56 in May. You know, we were like the latchkey kids and supposedly television was our babysitter. Right. And so I think for a lot of these kids, tablets, computers, phones have become babysitters. It's very easy. You give a child a phone. I mean, they are immersed in that for hours and hours. They're not in your way. And I think a lot of parents are extraordinarily lazy about that. And so I think that it's very necessary for parents that if you're going to let your child be online and the kids socialize that way now. I mean, that's how kids mm-hmm. socialize. Now. They play these games, they get on these, I guess, multiplayer games where they're talking to each other on FaceTime, but they're playing all together like in a game or and things like that. And that's a big part of their socialization now, as opposed to when I was a kid, you know, nobody did that. So we didn't have that sort of thing to do. But I think that it's incumbent upon parents and caretakers of children to really be monitoring. I mean, there's a lot of software out there. There's a lot of apps out there that can help you monitor what your kids are doing and who they're communicating with. And you have to be very careful and you have to be very diligent about that. I mean, what is more precious than the innocence of your child? I mean, nothing. I mean, what is more important? What's more valuable than that? There's absolutely nothing more valuable than that. So these parents really need to take the time to pay attention to what their child is doing online. And again, I think the internet is, it's accessible in a lot of ways. It's great. And because there's a lot of information out there. It's made business easier. It's made communication much easier, able to, find information, transfer data, different things like that. But there's also a lot of stuff out there that's just terrible and it's very easily accessible to kids. And so I think that parents really need to play more of a role in their kids' life as to knowing what their kids are really looking at online.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I think a lot about, you know, some of the conversations that I have with some of my younger peers. So I'm like in my early 20s, so very different kind of experience growing up. And the internet was such a big part of how I interacted with other people. But I think a lot about how vulnerable I was and how like little that conversation had been started about like who we need to watch out for, what's an appropriate kind of communication, it's not. Do you think that schools and administrators should like have a role in educating like parents and their students?
Absolutely. I think that schools, high schools, middle schools, I think probably should start in middle school, you know, maybe at the beginning of middle school, because when a lot of kids are beginning to kind of get online and do that sort of thing more and communicate with each other, you know, more. I think we should have classes just like they used to have home ec classes, which by the way, I think they ought to bring back, just like they used to have shop classes, which they ought to bring back. But we ought to have classes that teach these children how to appropriately use the internet. I think the schools ought to have resources for the parents in, hey, here are some apps that we suggest. Here's a mechanism we can offer you to help monitor your child's communications to help protect them. But we don't do that, you know, and we don't do that sometimes because we talk about invasions of privacy or we talk about different things like that. And, you know, it's our priorities really are kind of whacked in a lot of times in this country. We are really great to say, you know, hey, I want to do what I want to do and my privacy is my business or whatever, blah, blah, blah. And then something horrible happens. And then people are asking, why didn't somebody do something about it? So to some degree, you have to give up a little bit, you know, to get maybe a better result. And I think teaching these children early on about what's appropriate, what to look out for, these are some, you know, signs, you know, here's how someone could be trying to approach you to groom you, you know, don't give out any personal information, make sure that you're using, you know, some sort of VPN, make sure that, you know, you're using something to block IP trackers or whatever, you know, is there. They should be taught that and be offered that. And as well as the parents, I mean, the classes ought to be, there ought to be, you know, maybe just like they used to have, you know, back to school nights, there ought to be maybe some courses that the schools offer to, you know, teach these parents how to do that. The ones that are willing to put the effort in to do that, you know, because a lot of the responsibility lies with the parents. I mean, the parents need to take care of their kids. They need to pay attention. We can't have this, you know, society where we're all just staring into our own screens and we're ignoring what's going on around us, which happens quite a bit, unfortunately.
Hanson, one of the important things that we should talk about is you are one of our legal team members for the Take Beth and Knight support hotline for our survivors to call. I was so impressed by, you know, how obviously vehement and adamant you are about your position and support. Just talk to us for a second about what survivors should have when they call someone like you for legal support.
Well, when they call us, you know, the first thing that I can say is that if someone were to call us and they would prefer to speak to a female, I have a female client relations team members that could speak to them. You know, obviously we're in a judgment-free zone. You know, you don't blame somebody when they're a victim, which is something that I think is absolutely terrible that happens from time to time, particularly when the criminal defense lawyers are trying to defend these people, you know, but they should, you know, do their best to kind of have an outline chronologically of, you know, what happened, where it happened, when it happened, and do so in a way that's is as objective as possible. If that makes any sense, you know, obviously if they have any kind of evidence, if they have text messages, if they have, you know, screenshots, you know, these people send nude pictures and sexually explicit photographs, you know, and they encourage the children to do that as well. And they should
Wait, that was so important, Hanson. Go back so our listeners know what to say. Like, what should they preserve as evidence in cases like this?
They should preserve everything as evidence. And
like, and how?
Well, I mean, I mean, they should save it. And obviously, you know, you get into sort of a kind of a tricky gray area, because if a child sends a nude photo of itself to a teacher, then the child technically is guilty of manufacturing child pornography. I mean, really, that's sort of how the law is.
Oh, no. What do we do about that?
But here's the deal. Particularly in the federal system, okay, no federal prosecutor worth his salt or her salt is going to, I mean, they're going to understand what it is and they're going to use it as evidence and they're not going to come after the family. I mean, that would be outrageous if they were to do something like that. So, but I think the first thing is that if you were to notice that, you need to contact law enforcement immediately. You need to do that just as quickly as you can. And then it's in terms of the civil case, you just need to preserve absolutely everything you can. And the parents, you know, as outraged as they get, and I've had parents that were, you know, prepared to do violence, you know, and I had to talk them off the ledge. They can't do that. That's not going to help the child. They have to be as calm as they can and, you know, just be calm and let the attorneys do what they do and we'll get them in the end. And that's, you know, but it's hard. It's hard. You know, I mean, my heart, I mean, I have to say my wife gets kind of angry at me. She kind of wishes that I didn't take these kinds of cases because I get emotionally invested in them sometimes. But, you know, when you're sitting with these people, And most of them are all just good salt of the earth people. They're us. They're everybody. They're you know, I mean, and they run the gamut. They run the gamut from executives to guys picking up garbage. I mean, they're a cross section of America. But you know what they have in common? They love their children. You know what they have in common? They're horrified and outraged that something like this happened. Do you know what they have in common? They're grieving. They're grieving in such a deep way. It's profoundly deep, the grief they have. And again, the self-blame that they go through. And I do, one of the things that I do when I'm hired by a family is I really sort of have a come to Jesus meeting with them about them blaming themselves. And I do my best to disabuse them of the notion that they need to blame themselves, that somehow this is their fault. Because again, you don't send your kid to the Scouts. You don't send your kid to church. You don't send your kid to school expecting like any of this is going to happen. Quite the opposite. Those are supposed to be safe places. There's supposed to be places where the children are loved and cared for.
Yeah, okay, wait. Here's a couple more questions. We've done so much. First, since some of our listeners are survivors, and Hanson, you are one of our awesome members of the legal team representing your state, let's prep them for what they should gather to be prepared for the call. Like, what do you come back to the survivor and say, like, I need X, Y, and Z? What does that look like?
Well, that I basically would need any sort of evidence they have that something occurred. In other words, text messages, okay? You know, photographs. You know, if they went to the if they went up to the school because they were concerned. In this particular case over in Eastern Oklahoma, we know of at least four families that went, separate families that at separate times went to the school administration that knew and told them something weird's going on. Something creepy's going on. This, you know, my daughter's uncomfortable because this guy's rubbing up on her. And I mean, and of course they did nothing about it, but you know, so dates like that, just basically anything that they have, they can demonstrate that what they're telling us is the truth and that we could use to prove and to show in a court of law, hey, listen,
what if they say, I don't have any of that? What if they say it happened behind closed doors and it happened once or twice?
That would be tough, but we still would want to talk to them. I mean, that would be really, you know, Katie, just to be truthfully, that would be tough, but we would want to talk.
But don't you think that everything you said, Hanson, it might be that they can't prove it, but somebody saw them go into that closed door. Somebody, there was a camera in the hall, right?
If that evidence is still obtainable, sure. But in some cases, it could be that maybe it's impossible to prove. And if so, then, you know, at that point, you know, and that has happened, unfortunately. We've had, you know, one of the things that happens that really is kind of sad about doing this work is we will get phone calls from time to time about people who have been abused by family members. And there's really nothing we can do. I mean, there's no one to go. I mean, it's not from a lawyer's viewpoint. And now I'm just talking about the business of being a lawyer. You know, it's not feasible for us to go after this person.
What if they have assets, though?
If they have assets, that's different. But most of them don't, Katie. I mean, at least the ones I've seen, most of them don't. So at that point, our focus becomes on ensuring that this person gets the counseling, that this person gets sort of the support that they need to be able to try to heal. Okay, because I mean, you know, at the end of the day, okay, a person cannot let this define them. All right, they just can't. I mean, they can't, because when you are a victim of something that you had absolutely no control over, you cannot bring that in on you and somehow blame yourself. You just can't. And sometimes people have a tendency to do that. And the reason why they do that is because it gives them a sense of control. It's like, well, you know, if only I had done this. You know, a lot of people just don't want to face the damn randomness of life. I mean, you know, life is random and chaotic, and you know, you never know what's going to happen. And, you know, so, you know, people have belief systems and they do things. And a lot of times they really put a lot of pressure on themselves as simply a way of trying to, you know, assure themselves they have some sort of control, which really they don't. Nobody does. So our focus on situations where we can't do anything is really trying to get these people to resources, to counseling, to talk to people, to really start the healing process for themselves so that they can go about their life and they are not continuously hurt by the person who initially hurt them. Because why give those people a victory? Why give someone who hurts you that way that sort of a victory by letting it destroy your life? I mean, look at what you've done. You've done with your life. Who knows how many people you've helped? Truthfully, who knows what you've done over these years and how? I mean, and I'm not just saying this to you, but how brave of you at 18 years old to step forward and say, you know what, this happened to me. And especially back then, because I think you and I are kind of contemporaries. But I mean, you know, here's the thing, especially back then, I mean, you step up and you said something and you took something bad and you turned it into something good. And that's really my hope for a lot of these people it's my hope for all of my clients and all of the victims. But mainly, you know, for the people that we can't help in particular, at that point, our focus becomes on, listen, we wanted to give you some resources. We want you to, you know, we want you to really consider going to counseling. We want you to go and do what you need to do to begin the healing process. And for their families too, because, you know, the families, a lot of times, I mean, they're just torn up about this, and it's terrible. But I really strongly urge, I mean, I urge all of your listeners out there, you know, I mean, you know, write to your state representatives. I mean, contact your state reps, have them toughen up the penalties for people who fail to report. Write to your local district attorney's offices, you know, encourage them to prosecute people who fail to report. Because if people know there is a consequence for their actions or their failures, they will start doing the right thing, if out of no reason other than just self-preservation.
Yeah, let's talk about that as we kind of wind out. Emily, what are your thoughts on, you know, for Hanson and his expertise in legislation and initiatives for change?
I'm actually, I'm thinking a little bit about, like, at the university level, the protections that we kind of have in place, this like Title IX and things like that. And very often, like the HR or even offices like Title IX are more interested in like preserving the reputation of whatever university it is, the sort of institution at large. I'm sure that holds true, like even like at the elementary school level.
They want to keep those crime stats down.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so that, you know, that they're not named as a dangerous school to go to. I mean, I had a friend of mine's daughter that had something happen to her where she was slipped something into her drink. When I was in college myself, my friend and I were standing at the end of a bar. We witnessed a guy put something in a girl's drink. And as we headed over there, some other guys had seen it too. And by the time we got over there, this guy probably, I'm not sure what happened to him, but he didn't get out of there without a bunch of broken bones. I mean, they literally were just beating the living hell out of him. And in my opinion, rightfully so. I mean, I think rightfully so. But and in fact, the funny thing about that is the bouncers who came over there, you know, we were all kind of over there. The bouncers came over there and, hey, breaking it up. When they told the bouncers what happened, the bouncers started beating the guy up too as they threw him out. But and luckily that girl, you know, nothing happened to her. But, you know, terrible things happen on campus colleges. I mean, they really do. If I had a college age daughter, I'd probably be in more terror, you know, just for some of the stuff that happens. So I think that it begins, and it should begin really in high school, that we should, number one, we should train young men that, you know what, you have no right to do that to somebody. Whatever your physical lust is, whatever your physical desires are, you don't have a right to take something from somebody that they don't want to give you. And that's the first thing. So we ought to have a better culture for our young men. Okay. And secondly, we need to teach our young women how to protect themselves. I am an advocate that every young woman that's a college age, you know, if they're old enough and of age, they ought to learn how to use a pistol. They ought to learn how to use it properly. They ought to have mace. They ought to have a taser. I mean, or a shocking, or a stun gun or something in order to defend themselves. Because, you know, worse things typically happen to women than to men, you know, in situations like that. Although, you know, there are male victims too. And that's a whole nother category dealing. I mean, the psychological implications when you have a male victim that's a whole nother kind of, you know, can of worms there. But
wait, Hanson, pause on the mace idea. My FBI dad gave me mace too when I went off to college. But the line I use a lot when I speak, and I love your response to it, is I never accessorized with a mace around my neck on a date with Prince Charming. It didn't go with my outfit. You know, yeah. Like, how do we get past that barrier?
Well, then I think we need to make sure that our young women understand that he's not Prince Charming until you really know beyond a shadow of a doubt that he's Prince Charming.
And then the next question they shoot back to me, Hanson, is then when should I ever be alone with a guy ever?
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, I think Hanson,
I'm only throwing y'all everything at the kitchen sink. You're so good. Keep going.
Fine. And it's hard. I mean, I think that you really have, I think that young women really have to, first of all, you know, young women need to value themselves more. Okay. You know, they are more than just a pretty face or a pretty figure. They need to understand that they bring more to the table than just a body, and they need to not objectify themselves. Okay. I mean, mentally, they need to not objectify themselves. And so they need to use discernment. And they need to be as absolutely careful as they can. And they need to, when they begin to date people and people that they don't know, they need to do their research. I mean, there's Google out there. There's almost every state now has a state courts network where you can look up and see if people have been, you know, convicted of crimes. Ways to do background checks on people.
Wait, I have another idea. Most of the predators don't get caught. Remember? We just talked about it.
I mean, what do we do now,
Hanson?
I have some experience with something actually very similar where I went on a date with this guy or like met up with this guy a few times and ended up finding out several months later that he was a convicted felon. And it actually, like, he went through a lot of lengths to hide his identity. And the way that I found out was actually through, what's called like, an Are We Dating the Same Guy, group. So they, in these groups, women share bad experiences that they've had with men, things that, you know, wouldn't legally necessarily be like wrong, but it would be like, oh, he said something really disrespectful to me, or this person like has a history of being, you know, very aggressive or so-and-so to like other women, and they'll have, you know, documents of this. I actually believe that there's, I believe that there's actually an ongoing lawsuit because I think people, you know, were concerned that this was like defamation or something like that.
Mm-hmm. But I actually read something about a lawsuit where a guy was suing somebody on because he was placed on that site. And so I'll go back to what I said earlier about false accusations. If somebody puts a false accusation on somebody on one of those sites and damages their life, then the person who lied ought to pay a very steep criminal and civil penalty. However, you know, if someone is a bad guy, then, and their actions are revealed, then you know what? That's what they get. So I've got really mixed feelings about it. And that, I mean, but again, it's a culture problem we have. We sort of have a culture problem. I mean, you have a society where WAP wins an Emmy, but Baby It's Cold Outside is a date rape song. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, you know what? I mean, you know, it's kind of hard to say, hey, this is what we need to do when you have a culture that's just where people are just sort of like, hey, it's just friggin' a free for all out there. But it starts with, you know, young men need to learn how to value young women, and young women need to value themselves. They need to they need to understand that there is more to them than, you know, than just their sexuality, you know, and unfortunately, our society really puts a lot of pressure on these girls to, you know, they all want to look like the latest Instagram model or the Instagram influencer and things like that. And that's, I mean, look, you know, hey, you know, I'm a red-blooded male. I, you know, love, you know, beautiful women. I got lucky. My wife looks like the old actress Hedy Lamarr from the 1930s. They could be sisters. And so, you know, I mean, I can't say that I wasn't happy about that. I was very happy about that. But you know what? She's also pretty on the inside. You know, she's also a good partner in my life. She's also been a rock for me. I mean, we've been together 23 years now. I think we've spent three nights apart. We're together all the time. And I couldn't imagine, you know, life being any different but I value her. I value her advice. I value what she's brought to my life in terms of like helping me actually be a better person, you know, teaching me things about myself. And I think that there's so much emphasis on the shallowness in our society. There's so much emphasis just on the form and not the actual substance. And if there were a way for our people to start, you know, kind of having some sort of love and value for themselves, other than just physicality, other than just sort of, you know, the outside, you know, where people really do, you know, people learn to do something good. I mean, I'll just give you an example. I was watching a Facebook reel, and there was a Muslim imam from London on. And he goes, you know, when you go to China and you watch TikTok, you see young people in sporting events, you see them doing community services, you see them as entrepreneurs, you see business people, like you see TikTok, you know, entrepreneurs, you know, adults and other people having an ordered society to where they, you know, they're showing something good. You come to the West, what do you see on TikTok? Western Europe, the United States, you see, you know, so-called Karens, you see, you know, racism, you see fighting, road rage, people pranking one another. And some of these pranks are kind of dangerous. I mean, if you're just walking through Walmart and some guy in a Walmart, you know, jacket comes up to you and starts messing with you, I mean, you know, you're probably going to give him a bad reaction. And why is that okay to be filmed for somebody? You know, I mean, that's kind of a violation of that person's rights, I would think, to some degree. So I think that we ought to have a society to where we care more about one another and we work together for our, you know, our mutual good. I mean, you know, and this kind of segues over, you'd mentioned earlier in the introduction about the work I do in the African-American community. I do a lot of work here in Tulsa. I'm a member of the 100 Black Men of Tulsa. I was invited to join. I was very honored. I mean, I was a profound honor to be asked to join. And I'm a big believer that, you know, if the American dream is good enough for Chad and Kyle, it's good enough for DeAndre and Jamal, it's good enough for Juan and Jesus, it's good enough for anybody. And the fact is that we have certain demographics in our society through, you know, some say it's intentional, maybe unintentional, but there have been certain programs like the housing program that's been set up, which has devastated fathers in the community. Fathers have been separated from their children, which has resulted in a lot of dysfunction, a lot of harm, a lot of rudderless young men who don't have an example to show them how to be a man. And so if we would spend some of our time as a nation trying to do the things that actually improve the lives of all of our citizens, regardless of race or creed or sexual orientation or religion, but where we really decided, you know what, we're going to come together and we're going to try to build our country into a strong, strong society where we have a respect for one another, an appreciation for one another, and you can appreciate differences. I mean, one of the things about my life that I value the most, and I think that as I look back, because you know I'm getting in the autumn of my years now. As I look back, one of the things that's been the most beautiful thing about my life is that I had the ability and the luck to sometimes live in neighborhoods where I was the only guy that looked like me, and to have just this tapestry of friendships and relationships throughout my life of people who were different from me. They weren't, you know, they were completely different from me. And I learned a lot about them. I learned a lot about myself. And I learned to appreciate those differences and to see that there's strength in those differences. And so I think that, you know, the problem is just that our culture is a little bit, we're lost right now. We're just lost. I'm certainly not advocating any sort of like religious this or religious that or anything like that. But you don't necessarily have to have religion to do the right thing. I mean, there are certain things that whether you're an atheist or the most hardcore fundamentalist Christian, or whether you're a fundamentalist Muslim or whatever you believe, okay, there are certain things that are absolutely, you know, correct. All right, you know, hey, don't murder people, don't rape people, don't molest people. I mean, those are certain things anybody, any reasonable person could agree upon. And if we had some way that we could sort of begin to kind of, instead of just being angry with one another all the time, try to find a way to come together, to understand each other, to love each other ultimately. I mean, there's nothing we can't do. I mean, this is the thing about the United States of America. People die to come to this country. Think about this, okay? You have hundreds of thousands of people coming across the southern border, and they are brave. And I'm not even talking about whether that's okay or not okay for a second. I'm just talking about it happens. And these people brave traffickers, human traffickers. They brave cartels. They brave the dire conditions of the desert. Okay, you have people from Asia who, you know, deal with criminal organizations, and they pack themselves onto ships, and who knows what happens. People from Eastern Europe, and we all know that a lot of these young women from Eastern Europe are basically kind of sold into sexual bondage. And you have people from Cuba who literally will lash themselves to homemade rafts and sail upon the open ocean with the hope and the prayer that they get to Florida. Okay, people die to come to this country. This is the greatest country on earth. There is no place better than America. This is a place where just because you have a bad beginning doesn't mean you have to have a bad ending. You know, with grit and determination and planning and sacrifice, you can take something and make something out of nothing. And that dream, that ability should be open for all of our citizens. It should be open for the citizens in the inner cities, in the barrios. That's not a dream for blue blood people whose family came over on the Mayflower. It should be open to our brothers and sisters who are living on reservations in squalor and with drug abuse and dysfunction. I mean, what's been done to our native...
I'm only cutting you off because, my gosh, you could give a whole hour speech.
Okay, I'm sorry.
For the world to, like, Emily, you've never had a guest like Hansen, right?
This is so impassioned, and I see the vision.
I think, Emily, you've probably only known me a little. I think I couldn't hold a candle to Hansen, but sometimes when I'm at my best, I'm like half of Hansen.
Here's the thing. I don't like seeing people hurt. I like to see people do well. I like to see people be happy. I want to see people be successful. I want that little kid that's growing up in the projects to know that this is his America too. This is his America just as well. You know, and I want these barriers that have been constructed for him to be torn down so that he has a shot, just like everybody else. And that's really just how I feel. And I, you know,
all right.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, I want to sing glory, glory, hallelujah, but I don't sing, Hanson. I can't even do a darn cartwheel. I'm just being honest. You must have an amazing wife, and thank goodness that she looks like whatever actress you mentioned.
Hedy Lamarr. Hedy Lamarr was interesting because
she in The Birds with.
You're thinking of Tippi Hedren. Hedy Lamarr was an Austrian. She was married to a Nazi baron. She escaped Nazi Austria and came to the United States, and she actually helped invent radar. Yeah, she's in a lot of movies. Yeah, but you got to look at her. Just a ravishing brunette, you know.
All right, ravishing wife brunette. It's happiness to me, I'm sure, to Emily. I want to turn it back to Emily for a second, but before we do so, Emily, well, actually, we could probably go on for 2 more hours, but we just can't. Our listeners are usually begging off at an hour time. So Emily, what a amazing interview we've had with Hanson. Closing remarks on your reflection, you know, you have the entire scope of our episodes in your head. What should we close out with, Hanson?
Do you have a message for all of the young people out there to sort of inspire and provoke change?
Yeah, I think that they need to really examine the messages that they're hearing. Not everybody that comes to you with a smile on their face is your friend. And you need to really, think about, you know, there's been a lot said about, hey, you know, rugged individualism is, you know, toxic masculinity. I mean, those sorts of things. And you know, there's some of that that's true. There is toxic masculinity. Okay. But there's also, you know, men need to be men in some respect. They need to do what they do. I mean, you know, just as women need to be women. And I'm certainly not one of these kind of people that's like, you know, let's turn back the clock to 1950. I mean, that's never going to happen. And nobody wants that anyway, because the good old days weren't all that good for a lot of people. They weren't good for a lot of people. But I think that people need to use discernment, because a lot of times what people do is, you know, people have an agenda. Some folks have an agenda, and they gussy this agenda up with virtue signaling, and they gussy this agenda up with sort of these false narratives that really don't bear out. So my message for the young people out there is, number one, use discernment in the people that you decide that you want to support and follow. Really use discernment. I mean, really, and examine issues from all sides, not just from the side that seems to be popular, not just from what people are telling you. Really look at something and ask it, what is it in and of itself? Like, you know, Marcus Aurelius, I mean, one of my favorite philosophers, the Roman Emperor. I mean, he was a Stoic, but he was so on point about so much of what he said. You know, look at something and ask exactly what is it. And so when you're forming your beliefs, you know, have a real reason for your beliefs, not just because your friends believe something or someone tells you this or your professor told you this. Okay. Because unfortunately, there's a lot of what's being told to people that's just not true. It's for some agenda. And that's both on the left and the right. I mean, that's not just the purview of one particular, you know, political philosophy that comes across on all of them. So people need to try to use critical thinking. Okay. As you know, for the young women out there, I would tell them to be very careful. I mean, to be as careful as they can as they begin dating, and especially when they're first just moving away from home and they're going to college and they're kind of on their own and they've got all this freedom that maybe they never had before. You know, don't go overboard with that. I mean, you know, I mean,
wait, Hanson, I have an idea. I just thought of something. Light bulb came on. No one can know you that well on this podcast other than all the amazing things you're saying. What I was thinking is you've constantly asked for all of us to be stronger and more confident. I think you've said women should be confident in picking men and being strong and being able to stand up for ourselves. I think you've also asked men to be able to hear no when they're rejected.
Absolutely. Yeah, right? Absolutely.
And how, maybe we could go personal for a second. How did you come to ascribe to both strong women don't intimidate me, and if I get told no, I'm okay with it, and I'm a great enough man that if I hear no, I can accept it? How did you come to that knowledge?
Well, okay. So I'm I've always been a fan of women. I mean, I I've had women friends and they've been just real friends. I mean, like just real platonic friendship. I've always valued, women's opinions because I knew that they had a different perspective. And I was always willing to listen to that perspective. Not to overshare, but as a young man, and you know, when I was a young man, I was kind of a nice looking guy. I'll text you a picture here in a minute if you guys want to see. But
Handsome.
Yeah. Well, I now look like a fat old Italian stereotype. But here's the thing. Okay, I prided myself. I never once ever told a girl I loved her just to try to get her in a sack. I just didn't do that because number one, I respected myself. I didn't want to be that kind of person. I did not want to be that kind of a man. Okay, and so I think that what men need to do is they need to understand the world is a scary place for women. It is because just physically, I mean, you know, the physical differences between men and women and the fact that, you know, a man can physically impose his will oftentimes on a woman, you know, so I think men need to be sensitive to the fact that the world is in some respects a scary place and they should have an appreciation. And I don't want to sound paternalistic or parochial in any way, but also, a protective, I mean, some sort of, you know, you should have some sort of idea that, you know what, maybe it's your responsibility. If you see that a woman, maybe she's in distress and some guy's mashing on her or bothering her, maybe you need to step up and say something. Maybe you need to step up and intervene. And of course, you know, nowadays that could be dangerous. I mean, it could be, but I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, what is it they say? You know, a coward dies 1,000 deaths, the valiant die but once. I mean, I just couldn't. For me personally, I never was the type of person that, I mean, I would rather have taken a butt kicking than bow my head. So I never could stand to see women abused or mistreated. And in fact, you know, I've had a couple of instances here in restaurants where, I've seen guys, you know, speaking to women and, you know, these waitresses or young hostesses in a way my reaction wasn't all that great to it. I mean, and by the time it was over, I don't think they're going to ever do that again. So the two guys I'm thinking about in particular. But I think if more people would step up and say things and protect people, they'd be a little less this. These people wouldn't feel so emboldened. But as for me personally, I just always had an appreciation for women. I mean, I've had women friends throughout my life. I had women friends in high school. I had women friends in college. And I looked at them as genuine people, not just as some sort of object for my gratification, I guess, if that makes sense.
Wow. And did you learn that? I'm bemused by your stamina and your confidence, like meaning like you didn't care if you were rejected. How about this, Hanson? We close it out with a couple personal stories. One is you will teach everyone listening so much because you are so amazingly gifted at your craft. And you've accomplished a tremendous amount.
You're too kind.
No, Hanson, I'm being honest. I adored you the moment I talked to you. You're emphatic, energetic, visionary, demonstrative. Like, I could use so many adjectives for you. I'm sure Emily just met you today. So Emily could probably do the same.
My head's going to swell up if you keep talking.
No, remember you have a beautiful wife and she'll give you everything you need, but I'm only, you know, another intellectual person who's also passionate. And so is Emily. Both of us have been at this game, not nearly, well, me as long as you, Emily newer, but we're so emphatically determined to make change. And I still think we have not unlocked the Hanson key. Of like, how does a man grow up with such passion and commitment? Because most often we hear like, oh, I'm a survivor. Like some of the, like now that we built the legal team, Hanson, many say, oh, I come to this as a survivor myself. So I have credibility because I'm a survivor. Or they'll say my sister was raped or my mom was raped. And you're saying like, nope, I'm just going to be a great man. And so it's still like the coolest thing to say, well, I come to this table and you did it not just for this issue, but also for racism and a lot of things. You're coming to the table saying, let's make everybody filled as full as they can be and equal as possible. And that's a magical thing, Hanson.
Well, I guess if you want to know, I guess I could credit my grandfather. My grandfather looked like a cross between John Wayne and Marshall Dillon from Gunsmoke, the actor James Arness. I mean, they looked, especially with Marshall Dillon, I mean, they looked exactly. He was a big, big, strong man. He was a Golden Gloves boxer in the 30s. He was on a B-17 in World War II. And I ended up, going to live with him and growing up with him. And my grandfather was he was probably one of the most genuinely good men that I've ever encountered in my life. He was strong. He was tender when he needed to be. But he was also tough as nails. And I remember when I was about 6 years old, or maybe five, I came in and, you know, I said the N-word because I'd heard it at school. And my grandfather said, "Well, son," he said, "what do you think that word means?" And I said, "I don't know, Grandpa. I heard it at school." He said, "Well, you know," he said that word means a low-class person. He said, "There's plenty of white N-words." You know, he said, so he goes, "I don't want to ever hear you use that word again." He said, "That's a word that hurts people." And now this is back in the 70s, right? This is back in the 1970s. And then later on, he's told me a story because he kind of had a hard luck childhood as well. His mother had died and he had two sisters and they were 10 years apart, each one of them. So there was 20 years difference between him and his oldest sister. And so he was kind of shuttled from relative to relative before he went to go live with his oldest sister and her husband. But one of the places that he lived on was a big ranch down in southeastern Oklahoma. And he had the only kid on the ranch to play with was an African-American kid. And the kid's name was Oscar. And my grandpa told me how his great aunt would switch them. Every time she saw him playing or wrestling together, she'd come out and switch both of them and tell him that she didn't want him playing with that little boy. And he never understood it. And he also told me that the saddest thing he saw in World War II was how the black soldiers were treated. He said, here these guys were, they were coming over to fight for the country and they were treated just terribly. The British civilians treated them better than their own brothers in arms. And so he put a very strong sense in me of what is right and what is wrong as far as that sort of stuff goes. And he also taught me, he had a couple other sayings. He said, well, son, you know, to be a friend or to have a friend, you have to be a friend. And you have to be loyal to your friends. And you have to, you know, and sometimes you have to take a stand. And even if the stand's not popular, if it's right, it's right. And so, you know, I can tell you growing up with an archetype like that wasn't the easiest because, you know, I mean, it wasn't. I mean, because there wasn't a lot of room for a lot of emotion a lot of times. But he just had a genuine, really good sense of what was right and what was wrong. And I saw how he dealt with my grandmother. They were married for 70 some odd years and they had a relationship that was based on love and respect. And it was phenomenal. And I think probably I probably have to credit him for kind of putting it in me. I mean, one of the other things he used to say to me, take up for the underdog, son. You know, it's always easy to do what's popular and but if what's popular isn't what's right, you've got to do what's right.
Well, Emily, I leave it to you to close this out with any other final questions that are nagging at you or still in your mind, Emily. Anything else for Hanson?
Ooh, I don't know that I have a question. I do have this kind of thought that's been becoming a little bit more popular on social media recently, which, you know, say what you want about social media, but I think someone said that, you know, your principles aren't really principles until you've lost something for them. And so it's really important that even when we might lose something for doing what's right, that we do what's right because that's what's right. And I think that really just fits a lot with what Hanson has been saying today.
I agree 100%. You know, it's not always easy to do what's right, but it's always right. You know, and the thing is, you know, it's a lot of, and that's the problem. A lot of people just want to go along. They see things and they don't step up. They don't say things. For instance, I'll just say this. I think if more white Americans would speak up about the housing program in particular, okay, that because the housing program is where it starts. I don't want to go off on a tangent because I know we're almost out of time, but please let me just say this part of it. That you have a housing program that prevents families from being intact and being in subsidized housing. So consequently, particularly in the African-American community, a lot of single mothers, I think it's like 75% now or something like that, and their families aren't intact. Now, I know that there's people that believe that that was a plan and it's in a setup. And I, you know, I mean, I can see why people would believe that, because my God, we've seen now several generations. Why the hell don't we just change it? Change it. Let intact families be in housing. You know, let the father be there with his children. Let they put all the load on the woman, the financial load, the physical load, the emotional load, the spiritual load, and then they stereotype her as angry. You know, well, how can she not be angry? She's carrying all this by herself, and or she and her mother are carrying it. And so that is something I think that if more white people would stand up and say, you know what, we need to change this housing program. The goal of subsidized housing is to help people lift themselves out of poverty. Okay. We need to change this program. Hey, you know, God bless the people in the Ukraine. Okay. But I would rather my tax dollars go to help my people here in America. And I would rather there be real plans with accountability that help people learn to have better lives. The entitlement program. Literally, a woman, you know, single mom, she's got a couple of kids, they're on Medicaid. They're on Medicaid. She gets a job and she makes a little too much, and they strip her of her benefits for her kids, her insurance, her health insurance for her children, whatever food resources she's getting. We should be helping people till they can help themselves. We should be teaching people how to help themselves, how to be successful. Okay. I mean, that's what we need to be doing. We need to be helping lift our American brothers and sisters, regardless of race, regardless of sexual orientation, regardless of creed, regardless of religion. We need to help our brother and sister Americans lift themselves up out of poverty, lift themselves up out of dysfunction, and go forward and really fully participate in the American dream, participate in what is so great about this country.
Oh, my goodness.
Let me just say this last thing.
Yes.
People that look like us have got to start saying something.
Well, Emily doesn't look like you and I promise.
Well, she needs to say something too. I'm just not afraid to speak. Yeah. Because here's the thing. It's true for all of us, because that is the beauty of America. America wasn't built by just the pilgrims. America was built by, when you really read the history of America and the people that really, you know, did things that took the country forward in industry and business and in medicine, you know, they weren't just one group of people. They were a very diverse group of people. They were everybody. They were all flavors and creeds. And it's like, if we could just get over this identity politic bullshit notion and just start loving each other and helping each other, there's no limit to what we could do. And then we could try to change the world and make the world a better place. But we got to start at home.
Oh, my gosh. Hanson, we will have part two next year. for sure. This has been a glorious interview. Emily, thank you so much for taking this ride along with myself and Hanson. And Hanson, please don't, whatever I want to say, if you're, whatever your addiction is, I always say, like, everyone should take care. And addiction is like a harsh word. I'll say, if you're sniffing, doing brandy, if you're doing, I won't say any illegal drugs, if you're doing your wife, if you're doing your, you know, like, hopefully you're doing it all and legally, but you are giving our listeners the high of their lives and the impassion that I try to do all the time, and you outdid me for sure.
Well, I don't know about that, but I really appreciate the opportunity to be on here. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to your listeners. I hope I haven't offended anybody, you know, but I'm just talking from my heart. I believe what I say. And I really, honestly, you know, my prayer is I want to see us as a people, as an American people, come together and really start doing what's necessary. And it's not that hard. It's just not that hard.
I agree. It's not that far apart. And I think it's only our fear that divides us.
Absolutely.
I see the people united will never be divided. That's a chant from Take Back Monday, believe it or not. We've been saying it for 50 years. The people united will never be divided. And I think when we come together, we have a unification of what is right and wrong and who we need to help. And it is only fear of self-preservation often that makes us divided. But when we can see how we can connect with others, we do the greatest good for both ourselves and others. So I think you completely nailed it tonight on our discussion. Hanson, I'm so grateful.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Of course. And again, for our listeners, we have this robust network now for the legal support hotline for Take Back the Night. It is 1-567 Shatter. 1-567 Shatter. And we have an intake form, and you will be connected with folks as passionate and determined to help you as Hanson, who are really well informed about victimology, really steeped in so many others whom they've helped. So please don't hesitate to call. Please always tune in and listen to more of our stories, more of our shared visions like we did today. So thank you so much, Emily. Would you like to share anything else with our listeners about how to do self-care?
My self-care tip for today is to really relish in the small joys that you have every single day. So, of course, this has been a fantastic conversation. We've touched on so many different topics, and some of those topics are and can be triggering for a lot of people. And so after listening to this, make sure you take care of yourself, perhaps enjoy a sweet treat, take a nice bath. But as always, love yourself. And of course, we are all here to support you. Take Back the Night is here. And we're always available via our website on our social media at Dear Katie Podcast.
Thanks so much, Emily. And such a pleasure to talk with both of you this evening. Emily, of course, always, and Hanson. Keep doing the great work you're doing. And for our listeners, again, please don't forget what I said. You know, you'll reach out to someone Hanson's probably unique, but you'll reach out to our whole team when you contact us for legal support. We want to hook you up with the best, most compassionate folks who can give you straight up answers and tell you what your choices are for next steps for healing and support. So again, keep tuning into the Dear Katie Podcast. We look forward to welcoming you again for another episode. Take care. And together, we are not alone. Together, we are survivors, and we will thrive. Take care. Thank you again, everybody, for joining another episode of the Dear Katie Podcast. I hope very much you found today's episode helpful, empowering, and a way to take another step in that long journey toward healing and supporting those we care about, learning about sexual violence prevention, and also survivor support. For those of you who don't know, again, the Take Back the Night website has tons of great resources, books, self-care options, cool merch. If you're feeling like you need a wearable, we have great t-shirts. Of course, we would love it if you follow along on our free newsletter with news and events going on around the country and even around the globe. And finally, don't forget to like us and follow us on Facebook and Instagram. You'll find our entire community popping up here and there, and recaps of our podcast episodes as well. So together we shatter the silence, and together we end the violence. Take care.